Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for Wednesday, January 22nd, 2020. On today's episode, we're going to discuss what we've been up to at the water cooler. This is Slash Film Editor-in-Chief Peter Soretta, and joining me on today's podcast is Slash Film Weekend Editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
Senior Writer Ben Pearson.
Hey, what's going on?
And Writer Swatran Bui.
Hey, everyone.
And Chris Evangelista.
Hello, folks.
Okay, so we're recording this one before Ben and Chris leave us. They're going to Sundance. But before that, let's talk about what we've been up to. What have I been doing? I've been living at Disneyland, guys. I spent 3 days in a row last week at Disneyland. One was to cover the press day for the Rise of the Resistance ride, which just opened up, which is insane. And I've already talked about it on a podcast previously, but there's also a video you can watch online about that. I'll link to the Slash Film article on that. And then the next day was the actual opening of the ride, and all my friends were going, so I couldn't miss out and catch the craziness. And it's actually insane, guys. The way that they are doing this ride in Orlando and in California is unlike any ride has been handled before. They have this thing, so people aren't waiting. Normally at a theme park, you wait in line and you get, you know, how you know your time investment waiting in line gets you into the ride. And here in Orlando, they have this thing called boarding groups. So what happens is Disneyland opens at 8 a.m. And before the 8 a.m. opening, I think they like let people into Disneyland onto Main Street an hour early. So everybody's let in before Disneyland opens. And at 8 a.m., everybody has to go on their phone. And basically, it's the Comic-Con lottery, but on your phone in person in Disneyland, where you have to get in there, like right as the 8 o'clock opening starts, get in there, press a button, and hope that you won the lottery and that your group can get on the ride. And within, I think the first day it was within like 60 seconds or something, all the reservations for the day were gone. And I've talked to many people who have gone, and actually some people that went there opening day, that they camped out since midnight. They were in, it was raining, guys. People were in line in the rain, and then they got in there and pressed, they weren't quick enough to push the button and didn't even get on the ride. Yeah, fun times. But you can see my experience of going to this opening day on Ordinary Adventures. I'll put a link in the show notes. And did I get on? Did we get through to the lottery? You'll have to find out by watching the video. I went back to Disneyland for a third day in a row because over at Disney California Adventure, they celebrate Lunar New Year every year with this food festival. And it's all Chinese food, and I love Chinese food. And we ate everything, and we recorded it on video. And that video went up today, and I'll put a link to that also in the show notes as well. And I highly recommend if you are a Disney annual pass holder in California, checking that out, because there's not only is there good food, but there's also some Epcot like shows of like celebrating Chinese culture, and you know, of course, bringing in like Mulan and, you know, Disney characters like that as well. But and having Chip and Dale dressed in Chinese outfits, which is cute. Anyways, that's what I've been up to. I've been mainly at Disneyland, you know, getting up at 3 a.m. and driving down to Anaheim and being there all day, which I'm not used to doing. Brad, what have you been up to?
Well, I got all gussied up by my girlfriend. My girlfriend Brittany is obsessed with makeup. She loves doing people's makeup. She's very, very good at it. It's something that she wants to be able to do professionally in the near future. And so she had been bugging me for a little while to let her do mine. And originally she was trying to get me to do like a full face of drag makeup, and I was like, no, I don't want that much makeup on my face. I generally don't like putting like face paint or anything on my face, really. I hated it when I was a kid. I don't like the feeling of it. It kind of feels like my skin is suffocating in a weird way. But I decided to let her do like just like a general face of like male makeup, and you know, not make me up like a you know, like a drag queen or anything like that. And so she like did the whole spiel of like putting like all the foundation on and like some eyeliner and contouring my face and like even like darkening my beard. If you're interested in seeing the before and after, you can check out my Instagram, which is just my username is @BradfordOmen. And you can see that and see what it's like. I look like a magician, so Peter, you would probably really like it. I feel it made me look like I was going to go do street magic or something.
I don't think street magicians put on makeup, Brad. I think you're...
I'm pretty sure I've seen David Blaine wearing plenty of eyeliner.
No, I think you're thinking of Chris Angel. Actually, Chris Angel does wear makeup, but I don't think David Blaine wears makeup. You really think he wears eyeliner?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he does.
I don't know. Look up some photos. I will say, Brad, that this is a remarkable transformation. Like, looking at these two photos, like, I honestly thought it was Photoshop. Like, no,
some other people did too. Some of like people who know Brittany and know she has makeup thought that it was just like a joke and it was Facetune. But it was just the lighting was just done so well, and she took the picture in portrait mode with natural light, and it just looked really, really well done. So yeah,
she should look into doing like a makeup channel on YouTube. Not to try to get everybody in on YouTube, but I feel like this would have been a fantastic video to show this transformation.
That is what she wants to do, like on YouTube and Instagram, in addition to like actually, you know, doing it professionally for people, you know, whether it's for weddings and events or eventually, you know, maybe even, you know, bigger stuff. But yeah, it's she's very, very good at what she does. If you want to, she's going to be doing more of it soon. So, yeah, make check her out on Instagram, which is it's hold on a second. I forget the username because I forgot it's if there's an underscore or not. It's Brittany _ Teal, TEAL.
Yeah, I had no idea, like, on YouTube, some of the biggest things are toy unboxings and makeup tutorials.
Yeah, so she watches tons of makeup tutorials to get, like, better at what she does and see new, like, skills and different kind what the new makeup and, like, brushes and all that stuff is out there.
Well, it looks like she has skills. HT, as the only girl on here, did you see this photo of Brad in makeup?
Yeah, it's very impressive. I can't say I have any makeup expertise. I actually don't wear any makeup, so but it looks great. And I think you should wear makeup more often, Brett. Yeah. Not insulting your looks or anything, but you know, nothing wrong with a little makeup. I mean, I don't wear it, but
you know what's remarkable about this photo, I think, is the like the facial hair. Like she cleaned up your facial hair in a way that like I was like, is that possible with makeup?
Yeah, it's just the what she did the color. I think it's a pencil or something, and she just kind of like just drew in and like darkened the hair and made it look more full in spots. And I was super surprised by that too.
Yeah, HD, what have you been up to?
Well, I have had a couple of art prints just sitting around my room for a long time. And speaking of Lunar New Year, I've been kind of trying to prepare for it. I have sort of some superstition surrounding it because my mom has kind of raised me to believe in all of those things. So I want to get like the house apartment ready for it and not have a bunch of things lying over and wait from the last year.
Wait, what happens if you don't have, if they're like lying around?
If that happens on like the first, you know, week of Lunar New Year, then like whatever state you leave your life, your house in, it will be remaining like that for the rest of the year.
Ah.
So that's something that you want to, like, you want to have a clean house and you want to have, like, a good food and stuff and just be sort of ready. This is Vietnamese superstitions. Yeah. I don't know if this applies to all.
But you know what? That cultures, superstition sounds almost, like, practical. Like, it sounds like it isn't, like, an urban legend. Or that feels like it, like, could actually be true.
It is. I mean, probably. But there are some weird things, too. Like, for example, you want to clean beforehand, but you can't clean your house the day of. Because then that's like you're sweeping out all of the good fortune. So like people will leave like their house and like gathering dust for a couple of days in the first days of the new year, which is a kind of funny thing. But yeah, I've been trying to like prepare and get things ready. So I was like, I'm going to try to finally get these prints up. And I started to put up an animation themed sort of gallery wall in my bedroom. One of them inspired by the print that you got me, actually, Peter, 2 years ago, of My Neighbor Totoro print. And so I finally put that up, as well as this set of Chinese posters for Spirited Away that I bought on eBay a couple months ago and I really, really loved, as well as a print from Avatar The Last Airbender, which is by Matsumoto Art, something that I really love. It's kind of in the style that looks like an old scroll and has all the elements of the all the four elements in it, and a print of from Coco of the concept art, and lastly a little poster of Millennium Actress, the Satoshi Kon film that I saw at the Metrograph, and they gave some free posters out, so I was like, I'm gonna put that up. So that's what I have so far, and I'm really excited about it. I'm hoping to build it out eventually and keep it sort of animation themed, but I'm just very stoked about having that right now.
Is there any superstitions about, like, now that you've surrounded yourself in your room with, like, this art, like, what does that mean for your new year?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it just means I won't have more art creativity the entire year. Yeah. Maybe creativity. I don't know. I don't know, like, the specifics of it. I think it mostly has to do with feng shui too. Like, a lot of, like, not having a mirror in front of your bed, etc. But yeah, it just feels like good right now. So I'm liking that it's up finally and not just bothering me in the back of my mind. And it looks great. And I'm happy, excited about it.
Very cool. Ben, what have you been up to?
Well, my wife and I had a chance to go see the Frozen musical, the Broadway musical. It's touring right now in Los Angeles. It's at the Pantages Theater. So, we went and checked this out. This is the first time I've seen a Disney Broadway musical. I know I talked about Anastasia recently, but that was not based on a Disney movie. It's a big misconception a lot of people have. Anyway, I think Frozen is a much, much better musical, largely because most of the songs from the movie actually appear in this musical. They add a couple here and there, but for the most part, the story is pretty much the same. I just want to give a quick shout out to the two leads, Caroline Bowman and Caroline Innerblicker, I think is how you pronounce her name. Innerbickler, excuse me. So anyway, they were both fantastic as Elsa and Anna, respectively. I don't really have much to say about this other than, like, I would recommend seeing it if you're a big fan of the movie. I know we've had a lot of conversations, you know, amongst ourselves in the Slack Film Slack channel about Frozen and Frozen 2 and which one's better and all that kind of stuff. I think I still prefer the original Frozen. I really like that story a lot. So, I think my big thing with Broadway adaptations is, like, anytime they're not sticking to the story that I know from the movie that they're based on, it just kind of feels like, all right, let's get back to the real thing instead of, you know what I'm saying? Like, instead of, I don't know. I understand that that changes are necessary for adaptations. And actually, this musical, I think the creative team is, like, largely the same people, like Kristen Anderson Lopez and Robert Lopez, who wrote the music for the movie, did the music and lyrics for this show, like, including the new songs. And then Jennifer Lee, who's one of the co-directors of both films, wrote the book for this. So it's like the same creative team, but it still just doesn't feel, you know, the parts that are added just kind of feel like, all right, let's get back to the real story that is like the prime story. I don't know how else to explain it. But
is there any, like, musical adaptation of, like, a movie that is better than the movie itself?
Oh man, that's a really good question. I don't know enough about the Broadway world to be able to answer that, but I'm sure some of our listeners might
I know a lot of people love Lion King, but, like, what, and that takes a lot of creative liberties, I think, mm-hmm. with the adaptation, but do people prefer that over the animated movie? I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's a good question. And then there's, like, the whole separate issue of, like, movies that are based on stage plays, Broadway productions, you know, going the reverse way. So, I'd be interested to hear what people have to think or have to say about that. If there's any movies that are based on, musicals that are based on movies that ended up being better than the movie that sort of inspired them. That's a good question.
Yeah, I think today in the news on the site, we have a story about they're turning Karate Kid into a musical for Broadway, which just sounds like, as a person who loves Karate Kid, that sounds like a horrible idea.
Yeah.
Sounds bad. They're also making a Back to the Future musical. Back to the Future is my favorite film of all time. I also think that's a bad idea, but I'll see that one. I don't know. Okay. Anyways, Chris, you're headed to Sundance. Are you freaking out about the plane flight?
I sure am. Anyone who listens to this show probably knows by now that I am petrified of flying. And no matter how many times I do it, I just can't seem to get used to it. And I keep thinking, like, I'll adapt, but I obviously won't. And so, yeah, I'm just in a weird headspace. I'm excited to be going. I'm excited to go back to Sundance. I wish I could literally, like, be drugged asleep, carried onto the plane, and then wake up in Sundance. And to make matters worse, I actually have to, I was unable to find a nonstop flight, so I have to fly to Atlanta first, and then I have to get back on another plane and fly from Atlanta to Utah. So now there are two opportunities for me to die in a fiery wreck, so that'll be fun.
You'll be fine, Chris.
And, you can do it, Chris.
You know, when it comes to this, anytime I'm about to fly, I get very superstitious and I see everything as an omen, like I'm in a Final Destination movie. And today I went to check in on my flight. You have to check in your seat.
Yeah.
And the website I was using literally crashed as I was checking in. And I was like, well, this is a very bad sign. The website is crashing. Therefore, the plane will be crashing as well. That's how my mind works. So, well,
Chris, to make you feel better, I also had to check in for my flight today. And the website that I was using also crashed. So right. I guess that means we're going down in flames together, buddy.
All right.
Oh, no.
You know, it's a very weird, I wish I could get out of this headspace. When I went to New Orleans over the summer for the Overlook Film Festival, and this is also how my mind works. So I fly out of Philadelphia, and Phil Noble, who is the editor-in-chief of Fangoria, flies out of Philadelphia too, because he's also from Philadelphia, and he was on my flight. And in my mind, I was like, all right, he's an important person, therefore the plane will be safe. So because I'm on the same plane as him. And another time I was on a plane with Joe Dante, the director. And I was like, obviously the plane with Joe Dante on it won't go down, so I'll be safe. So that's how I look at it. I need like a famous person on my flight. And that makes my mind be like, well, no one will bring this famous person's plane down.
Just pretend that M. Night Shyamalan is going to be on the flight going to Sundance to check out some new indie talent.
All right. Maybe I will.
See, I just imagined that someone like Joe Dante, we're going to find out, does die in like a plane crash. So
thank
I feel
you,
like,
Peter. That's helpful.
No, but I feel like if I was on the plane with Joe Dante, I'd be like, oh, there's a bigger chance of it happening, because if it just happened with me on the plane, then like it wouldn't be notable. It'd just be a plane crash. But, you know, now that Joe Dante is here, like it's going
like
to be.
That's somehow like darker than my outlook. You're like the complete opposite, where you're like, ah.
That guarantees it.
Yeah. I also have superstitions stemming from Final Destination. Like, I know in that original movie there was a shot, I'm not even sure if it's insinuated, I haven't revisited that movie in so long, maybe Chris you know, but there's a part where they have like the tag on the luggage from the previous flight and they rip it off before the flight, and it's kind of insinuated that that was bad luck, of ripping off that tag was the reason why this flight was gonna crash.
So I
end up leaving on those on my luggage, and I have like 15 of those tags all over my luggage.
And that's why you're safe.
They should turn those Final Destination movies into like PSAs for the TSA. Be like, oh, if they don't want you to remove those tags, then they just put it into a Final Destination movie and turn it into a superstition.
Yeah, but I'm worried that like leaving these tags on are going to get my like luggage lost, though, is the problem. Like, it's
small price to pay for surviving, Peter.
Okay. Let's move into what we've been watching. Chris, you watched Killer Inside?
Yes, this is a new Netflix true crime docuseries. It's 3 episodes. It's called Killer Inside, The Mind of Aaron Hernandez. And I was vaguely aware of the stories because I remember the headlines, but I don't really, you know, follow sports and I don't really follow football, so I didn't know the whole details. But Aaron Hernandez was an NFL football player, and he ended up going on trial and getting convicted of one murder, and he was accused of 2 others, and he eventually died by suicide after he was convicted. And the story like goes into, you know, his rise as this great football player, and you know how, and his downfall. And it was a really fascinating watch, because again, I didn't know a lot about this, so watching it really clued me into the whole story. And I believe Ben watched this as well.
I did. I actually went to college with Aaron Hernandez. I was walking around the University of Florida at the same time as him. I you know, went to all the football games and watched him play and cheered him on from the stands. So this was a really weird experience for me. I did not really follow his career in the NFL, but I was a huge, you know, college football fan. So, like you, Chris, I sort of was vaguely aware of the details of this case because, you know, those headlines were everywhere that like an NFL player was arrested for murder and it was like a huge deal. But there was so much in this documentary that I didn't know about, even in terms of like the specifics of the case and like those other murders that he was accused of. There were, and even like the reason for his suicide, I just sort of drew lines in my own head from the points that I was aware of at the time and just sort of was like, oh, he must have committed suicide because of or taken his own life because of this and this. And then I just sort of like wrote it off and never really looked into it. But this documentary does a really good job of sort of painting a much broader, clearer picture of what kind of person this was, what kind of things he suffered from, his upbringing, like everything. So it's really interesting. I think my only complaint would be that I thought, even though it's a three-part documentary, I thought it was a little bit too long. There are times where I thought it sort of dragged out and there were one too many, or maybe several too many instances of people being like, here's a guy who had everything and I can't believe he killed someone, or yeah, you know, like that kind of stuff. Like people hammering the same points home over and over again and like talking head style. But aside from those, you know, small instances, I feel like the whole thing could have just been tightened up just a little bit and it would have been infinitely better, but is still, I would say, worth a watch, especially for people who don't know all of the details. I'm sure we have a lot of people listening who are like huge sports fans and who followed this story very, very closely. And I'm not sure what, you know, what you might learn there, but as somebody who just followed it, you know, vaguely from afar, I found it to be a really interesting watch.
It's funny. I feel like Netflix has like a mandate for like these, like, true crime kind of thing, like instead of like a movie, like this could have been a 2-hour movie, right, or a 2.5-hour movie, but like it's a 3-episode miniseries, and I feel like a lot of their stuff is like these 3-episode miniseries now. I'm wondering, like, they probably have some stats, they're like, oh, if we have a 3-episode miniseries, they'll get people binging, and I don't know. It's I'm just curious why the contents of that rather than make this into just like a proper documentary.
Well, I think this one in particular is structured in such a way where 3 episodes make sense because it's sort of like each episode covers a different period of his life where he's playing football. So like the first episode is sort of like his, you know, his childhood and like playing in high school and stuff like that. And the second episode is more college. And then the third episode is sort of like his NFL career. So, you know, the distinctions there make sense. I just wish that all of the episodes were like a little bit shorter. And then I think this would have been, you know, pretty close to to excellent. But as it is, I still think it's very good.
Okay, what have I been watching? I finally got around to see Little Women. This is a film by Greta Gerwig, and honestly, it was a film I wasn't looking forward to because the Little Women story is not something I have liked. And, you know, I've never read it, but I've seen, I think, at least 2 of the previous adaptations. And I lived near Concord, Massachusetts, where the Little Women house was, and I visited there a couple times. And I was sitting in the movie theater watching this, and I was, I gotta admit, like, I was a little bit bored, and a little, until there was a moment in the film, I'm not sure how far into the film, no spoilers here, but it involves fire. I think that's fair enough not specific, that moment sucked me in, and then, like, for the rest of the movie, I totally enjoyed this film. I love the performances, I love her take on this and what she's doing with it. It's interesting examination of like societal pressures on women of that time, and you know how it kind of correlates to today and stuff like that. I enjoyed it. I would recommend it. It wasn't one of my favorite movies of last year, but I did like it quite a bit. So I'm glad I saw it. And
Yay.
I just hope Greta Gerwig does more stuff not in period settings, because I don't
love... I mean, her two past films were technically period pieces.
I know, but yeah. I'm cool with modern day period pieces. It's more of, I don't know, it's stuffy period dramas that don't get me. The other film I saw was Brittany Runs a Marathon, and this is a film, did it premiere at Sundance? I think, Brad, you liked this film, right?
Yeah, it was at last year's Sundance.
Yeah, last year's Sundance, and this is now on Amazon Prime, so everybody can see it. I gotta admit, this is another film, though. Like, when it started out, it seemed kind of like cutesy and inspirational, and it didn't seem to like have like that much depth, but by the end of it, it really does go a little bit deeper and is more emotional than I was expecting it to be, and you know, I was crying, so that tells you something. I really did enjoy it. I would recommend this, and this is on Amazon Prime now. It's called Brittany Runs a Marathon. Brad, what did you watch?
I got around to seeing Hustlers finally. And, man, that movie was way better than I thought it was going to be. I was surprised when Chris said that he put it in his top 10, because I was like, wow, is it really that good? And that made me want to see it more. And it wouldn't have cracked my own personal top 10. It probably would have ended up in, like, the top 15 or the top 20. But it is just – it's fantastic. It's so lively and full of energy, and it's just a real stick-it-to-the-man kind of movie. Jennifer Lopez is great in it. So is Constance Wu. It's really funny. It's, you know, it feels like The Wolf of Wall Street, but like me with a heist movie kind of a flair to it. And I just really can't say anything more than that. That is fantastic. And if I had seen it beforehand, I would have pushed maybe at least slightly for a movie moment from this movie that wasn't Jennifer Lopez's introduction, because that was awesome and totally is the best moment of the movie. But I was laughing so much. There's a scene when Usher comes to the strip club that they work at, and all the girls are like freaking out about it, and Usher just rolls in slow motion, and it's just such a hilarious and awesome scene. I loved it.
Cool. What else have you been watching?
I noticed that Pain and Glory was surprisingly playing nearby me, which was unexpected, since that's a kind of movie that doesn't usually make it to my local Cineplex. So I went out of my way to see that, since Antonio Banderas has been getting a lot of buzz for his performance. It's a movie by Pedro Almodovar, and it follows Antonio Banderas as a filmmaker who's kind of ailing in his older years. He's got a lot of health problems, and he reconnects with some old people in his life. I don't really want to give anything away, but it's this very introspective and retrospective thing that's inspired by Pedro Almodovar's own life, and Antonio Banderas is so good in it. And it's I went into this really blind. The only thing I knew is that Antonio Banderas's performance was great in it, and that Pedro Almodovar directed it. So I just went with the flow, and it's such a touching movie. It's a little odd in parts, but not in an off-putting way. And it's just this. Yeah, this great movie that kind of just looks back at legacy. In a way, it's almost it kind of feels like Pedro's own The Irishman, in a way, though not quite as epic or sprawling in nature, but just the way that it reflects on life and legacy and like the people in our lives and that kind of thing.
Cool. And what else have you been watching?
I also saw The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which is currently available on Amazon Prime. And this was one where I also didn't really know much about it, but I had heard some good things from people. I'd seen it on a couple top 10 lists, and my girlfriend had been wanting to watch it since she had heard that it was pretty good as well. And it's directed by Joe Talbot. It's his first movie. This is a movie that garnered, a lot of attention. Because he was really kind of like a grassroots filmmaker, where he got into it and really didn't have any skills or know anything about how to make a movie, but had an idea to make one with Jimmy Fails, who is essentially plays himself in the movie. And they had like a Kickstarter campaign and raised all the money to make it. And he got advice from Barry Jenkins and met with like Plan B. And it really is this like true indie movie. And it follows these two young black men who are living in San Francisco. And one of them, Jimmy Fails, is obsessed with fixing the house that he used to live in as a child, even though there are other people living there. And then when they move out, they basically like try to squat in it and stay there. And it's just this entire thing of him trying to get this house and recapture, you know, basically this what he believes is this historical part of his family. And it's a bit strange in its presentation, but it's never boring. It's you're always kind of compelled because you're wondering exactly where this is going and what's happening. The performances in it are outstanding. The cinematography is gorgeous. The way they shoot inside and outside this house is beautiful. And it's a little bit of a slower burn, and it's challenging at times. Not necessarily because it's boring, just because it doesn't really like lay everything out for you in the most obvious way. But if you're interested in checking it out, like I said, it's on Amazon Prime. I definitely liked it.
Very cool. And you had one more thing to talk about today?
Yeah, so we don't have any really new episodes of British baking show to watch anymore. And so my girlfriend saw that there's this show on Netflix called Zumbo's Just Desserts. And it's this Australian chef. Apparently he's very famous down under. He has his own restaurants and everything. And it's a dessert, baking competition show. It's not quite as charming as British Baking Show because it's a little bit more competitive, and the hosts aren't as endearing, but the creations are a little bit higher quality and more difficult to pull off. So it's fun to watch in that way. Interesting to see what kind of creations they come up with. And like the set that they use is almost like this industrial Willy Wonka's chocolate factory kind of set. So it's pretty entertaining. It's a good one of those good just like sit down, relax, and just watch them make delicious desserts kind of show.
And where can you find that show?
That's on Netflix.
Netflix. HT, what have you actually went to the theater and saw Doolittle?
Yes, well, I didn't pay for it, if that makes everyone feel better.
Well,
but
you did
Doolittle.
Pay for it with your time, HT.
I did. Well, I saw Doolittle, so you didn't have to. And you don't have to because it's a bad movie. This is Robert Downey Jr.'s big project after the Marvel Cinematic Universe, after his career-defining role as Tony Stark in the MCU. And it was a very poor choice. It was it's directed by Stephen Goggin, and it's a remake of the Dr. Doolittle story. It's done in a way that is actually more accurate to the original story by Hugh Lofting, and is inspired by his novel The Voyages of Dr. Doolittle. This is a movie that is very, very obviously cobbled together by reshoots and bad CGI and jokes that do not work at all. There is one joke in which Dr. Doolittle is trying to dislodge the rectum of a dragon who does appear in this movie and discovers all sorts of armors, skeleton, swords, and when he finally dislodges it, she rewards him with a big, long fart in his face and a thank you. And it's such a bizarre, bad moment that is just, it went on forever, first of all, and felt like the embodiment of everything wrong with this movie. The jokes are very anachronistic and done in a way that's very like supposed to be tongue in cheek and modern, but come off as very just unfunny altogether. And Robert Downey Jr. is doing some sort of accent as Dr. Doolittle. It sounds kind of like an approximation of a Welshman mixed with the Welshman being like stabbed or something. But yeah.
He apparently based it on some kind of Welsh doctor or something like that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's interesting because at the beginning of the movie, they start with this really sweet and whimsical storybook opening. And I was like, okay, maybe this has some promise to it. Maybe this will be similar to how Paddington like upended our expectations for it and became the sweet, whimsical story. And I feel like there are sometimes glimmers of that in Doolittle, but then it just gives in to doing sort of lots of fart jokes and making refines. Say a line like, oh, my berry balls. So it's bad.
and it didn't do well at the box office. Do you think that's because the audience could smell it from, you know, the stink from far away. Like, it's weird because Robert Downey Jr., I feel like today is like one of the biggest movie stars. But is there any value in movie stars if they can't get people to see the stinker?
I mean, the movie star, the idea of the movie star has been dying for a couple of years now. There isn't anyone who has that box office draw, even the ones who are the highest paid people on the Forbes list every year. Like Dwayne Johnson is supposedly the one sort of consistent movie star, but even he has bombs. So, and Tom Cruise too has plenty of bombs. So it seems like this is definitely the death knell of the movie star because even Robert Downey Jr. and his bad Welsh accent can't save this.
Okay, you also saw The Gentlemen?
Yes, this is the new Guy Ritchie romp. And I didn't really know what to expect going into this. From the marketing and the posters, it seemed kind of like he was trying to recapture his old sort of hyper-violent gangster gangster film that he had become known for, like Lock, Stock, and Smoking Barrel and Snatch, and also have a sort of Kingsman-inspired style. But I actually kind of enjoyed this film. It is a little bit of a mess, and I think it's trying to say something that doesn't have the skill to say about class divides and generational divides, but it is pretty fun based on the power of the ensemble, which includes Matthew McConaughey, Hugh Grant, Henry Golding, Michelle Dockery, Charlie Hunnam. The best part of this is Hugh Grant as this really sleazy reporter, and he's just hamming it up and having a ball. I think that ever since he started in Paddington 2 as a villain, he has been kind of unleashed and is sleazing and sliming it up as much as possible, and he's just having a blast in this movie and is kind of the reason a lot of it works. Colin Farrell also appears for a brief minute and is a scene stealer as well. But the movie itself is a little convoluted and feels sometimes like Guy Ritchie is trying to recapture his best beats and his own style. But it is it gets propelled through by the performances of the cast.
So people should go see this?
Yeah, I'd say if you have a weekend free, see it. Don't go out of your way to see it, but it's pretty enjoyable.
Okay, what else did you see?
I got the chance to see Weathering With You. This is the new Makoto Shinkai film. He is the director of Your Name. It's a movie that I raved about. It was one of my favorite films of 2017. And this was a movie that I was really anticipating, crying my eyes out, and that sort of cosmic romance that Makoto Shinkai really nailed with Your Name. And it has that same sort of cosmic centerpiece and as well as a lovely romance, but doesn't have quite the emotional punch that Your Name has. It leans a little bit more on the comedic side. It has some more slapstick moments, and is really, really a sweet film that is actually about climate change and the dangers of climate change as well. But its message is a little muddled, I think. I can't say what exactly the message would be. I think this is my reading upon it, is that like Makoto Shinkai took to heart some of the people sort of proclaiming him to be the next Hayao Miyazaki and decided to go for this really strong environmental message. But he doesn't really know how to follow through with that environmental message. And it seems like at the end of the film, he's kind of dooming the Earth to something a little less happy than what the happy love story ending ends up being. So it is interesting. It's a little bit of a muddled film, not as strong as a film as Your Name, but really enjoyable, really beautiful, beautiful watch. I think Makoto Shinkai and his blend of 3D and 2D animation his renderings of photorealistic Tokyo as well have a real magical quality to them that are worth seeing in the theater for sure. Just don't see it with a lot of anime fans because they will be talking the entire time and laughing every time someone says a curse word in Japanese because it's just so funny.
Wait, why are they talking?
I was at a fan screening for Weathering With You, and it was full of fans who were very enthusiastic, but were just talking the entire time. And I was watching the Japanese voice version with English subtitles, and people behind me were just very excited every time they said "kuso," which means "damn." And so I just it was very annoying, but the movie itself was great. And the songs as well, are really fantastic. So that's Weathering With You. I think it's, it might actually be out of most theaters by now, but if you have the chance to see it, please do.
Okay. What else have you been watching?
All right. I've seen a couple other films. This is a movie that I actually had seen last time around, but forgot to talk about. So this is Transit, which is a German romantic drama directed by Christian Petzold. This was when I was catching up on my 2019 movies. And this is a movie that I really enjoyed and was really transfixed by. It is based on a World War II novel by Anna Seghers, and is about a refugee who is fleeing a fascist state. But it's actually set in modern day and has this kind of timeless feel to it that lends to this unsettling effect of not knowing where or when you really are. Then this refugee is played by Franz Rogowski, and he is attempting to escape occupied Paris for the Americas. And he ends up taking on the name of a well-known writer who had died, taking his documents to try to escape the fascist state. And he runs into the wife of the writer and falls in love with her. And it's this really sort of dreamlike film that is like Casablanca meets La Jetée. It's very slow and surreal, but I found myself really mesmerized by this film, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. It didn't make my top 10 of 2019, but it's actually high up there. It's in my honorable mentions, and it's really fantastic. That's called Transit, and it's actually streaming right now on Amazon Prime. A couple other movies I watched were The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie. This is the film by Louis Buñuel, sorry. And this is actually a film that I thought I'd seen because my dad has a funny story about watching this when he was living in France and gone on a date to see this. And he told this story so many times about how he'd seen it and hated it, and that I thought I had actually watched this film, but I hadn't. I got a chance to watch it on the Criterion Channel, where it's streaming now. And it's a 1972 film directed by Louis Buñuel, who is a surrealist artist, best known for films like That Obscure Object of Desire, or La Chienne Andalou, the film where the woman's eye gets cut. I think that's his, yeah. But this is a film that kind of fittingly comes like after our year of Eat the Rich films, because I feel like this film is one of the OG Eat the Rich, or rather Keep the Rich from Eating, because it's about a group of upper middle class friends living in France during a time of political turmoil, who keep trying to make plans to eat dinner together and keep getting thwarted in more absurd and more bizarre ways. First time it's because of a miscommunication, and then the second time it's because they find a dead body in a restaurant, and it keeps getting more and more bizarre as it goes on. They're interrupted by a terrorist cell at one point. They're interrupted by a couple military drills, and the second half of the film actually takes place almost entirely in dream sequences that are disconnected from each other, but they're dreams of each of the members of the friends. Some of them are dreams within dreams, and they're all intertwined in a way that is very unsettling, but is really enjoyable to watch, and very funny too, despite some of the more bizarre moments of the film. And that's The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, which you can find on the Criterion Channel. I also
did you call your dad and be like, "Dad, you're wrong. This movie's good."
Yes, I was like, "You were wrong. 16-year-old you was wrong." But I don't think he would like it now. It's definitely not a film he would enjoy. And another film that I watched although I think this was actually off streaming now. This is a film called Delicatessen. I watched it on Amazon Prime, and it is directed by Jean-Pierre Jeunet and Marc Caro. This made headlines a couple years ago, back when director Jean-Pierre Jeunet accused The Shape of Water director Guillermo del Toro of plagiarizing him for the scene in which the characters were dancing with their feet to a silent movie, or to a classic movie that was airing, like that was airing on the TV next to them. And there is definitely a very musical, rhythmic tone to this entire film, which is very bizarre. It's a post-apocalyptic film set in post-apocalyptic France in a rundown apartment building run by a butcher who routinely lures in new victims in the form of like handyman ads and trying to get the employees, and will kill them and sell them as food to his tenants. Because this is in this post-apocalyptic future, there is no meat. The only thing left are grains, which are used as currency. So all the people in this apartment building are meat eaters, and they kind of allow this to slide because they don't want to be killed next. And the newest of the disposable workers is a former circus clown who steals the heart of the butcher's daughter, and she decides to try to save him from her father's wrath. And it's a very weird, kinky film. There's this mustard yellow sort of saturated color palette to this entire thing, it can be very off-putting at first, but if you like films like The City of Lost Children or Amélie, which Jean-Pierre Jeunet would eventually go on to direct, Amélie is a much more toned-down version of this film. This is one of his first films, actually, and definitely his strangest. But that is Delicatessen, and it used to be streaming on Amazon Prime, but you can rent it for now on Amazon. And after all that, you know, fancy French films and good films and other theatrical films, I decided to watch a bunch of trash on Netflix. So on Netflix, I binged two series, one of which is called The Circle. It's a reality show that is an American remake of a British reality series. And it's a Netflix reality show about a group of contestants who move into an apartment building where they cannot interact with anyone else except through this social media app, in which is shown on all the TV screens in this apartment. And they never meet them face to face, or do they know whether the people they're interacting with through this social media app are real, because the contestants can choose who they want to be, whether they are themselves or whether they're going to catfish and be someone else on their social media profiles. And it seems at first like this really mean-spirited social experiment, and I wasn't really into it for the first half of the episode. And then for some reason, I got completely pulled in. I can't in good confidence say that this is a good show, but it sure is an entertaining show, and one that is surprisingly wholesome at times, because this kind of takes the common refrain in a lot of reality shows where people say, "I'm not here to make friends," and reverses that, because these people really are here to make friends. The goal of the show is to become the most popular person as voted by all the other contestants. So everyone is trying to make connections and make alliances and try to figure out who they can connect with to be at the top. But in the end, they actually end up making a lot of genuine connections despite never seeing each other in person. And some of the most heartfelt moments are between just like these two bros who are from completely different walks of life, one of which is like this very typical Jersey boy who looks like he's a reject of Jersey Shore, and another one is an Indian American sort of UCLA grad who works in like VR programming, and they become best friends, and it's really sweet. And it's a surprisingly, I think it the show itself, like the contestants, made it more wholesome than the show intended it to be, because a lot of the games that they have are intended to sow discord and everything. But the players in the end end up bonding and forming actual, as far as I could see, genuine bonds than anything. So that's The Circle, which is now on Netflix. It's 12 episodes. So if you have a couple of days and want to turn your brain off, it's pretty fun. Another show that I can't say in good confidence is good, but is entertaining, is The Witcher. And this is a show that I wish Jacob was on today, because he, I think, was the most excited about this. This is based off of both a video game and a Polish novel upon which the video game was based. It takes inspiration from more from the Polish novel, but I know that Henry Cavill, who stars in it, is basically doing an impression of the video game character. This is a high fantasy series about a mutated monster hunter, the titular Witcher named Geralt, who goes around killing monsters and finds himself with his fates intertwined with several other people. I can't say it's a good show. A lot of the world building and the plotting is quite confusing and convoluted. There are actually three timelines happening in this show, like three separate timelines, and it's not clear that there are three separate timelines until about halfway through the series, and you're like, oh, this is taking place in the past. But it's quite fun, despite some of the how gruesome it can sometimes get, which I think takes away from the show sometimes. I think they go a little overboard. But there's this unintentionally campy element to it that makes it really enjoyable to watch. Henry Cavill gives a surprisingly comedic performance, despite how gruff he is. He has like a million ways of saying, of grunting, which is really hilarious. And there's, of course, his sort of sidekick, Jaskier, who is a bard who sings that song, Toss a Coin to Your Witcher, which was the reason I started watching this show, because the song is insanely catchy and becomes sort of the fun comedic focal point of this show, and made me realize, like, oh, this is what the show is or should be instead of what it's trying to be. At some points, it feels kind of like a sci-fi channel series that's given a cable-sized budget, and the writing itself feels very like sci-fi channel-esque too, but it's just kind of fun. I enjoy the camp, whether it's essential or not, and the characters too are mostly enjoyable. Geralt and Yennefer are the ones who are the standouts for me. Yennefer is sort of this witch who becomes very powerful and eventually crosses paths with Geralt as well, and that's The Witcher. A fun, riotous, good time.
See, I turned this on last week or whenever it came out, and I think we watched like 5 or 10 minutes before we decided it wasn't for us. But this has become a huge hit for Netflix, it seems.
The first episode is bad, I have to say. I watched the first episode and was like, oh, that was a bad episode. But it gets better in episode two when Jaskier comes on board and you're like, oh, this is actually a hammy a campy comedy. So once it stops taking itself so seriously, it becomes more fun.
Well, very cool. And that is on Netflix. Ben, what have you been watching?
Speaking of things that you can't say with any confidence are actually good, I watched Six Underground, which is the new Michael Bay movie that's on Netflix. This thing dropped on, I think, December 13th. So it's been on there for a little while, but I haven't really seen too many people talk about this. It's the Ryan Reynolds movie that has an ensemble cast that includes people like Dave Franco and Melanie Laurent. Corey Hawkins from Straight Outta Compton is in this as well. Has anybody else here seen this movie? I'm curious. I don't remember if anybody's mentioned it on a previous article.
I got about 15 minutes into this and I said, I'm done with this. even from like a Michael Bay standpoint, I found this like unwatchable.
I don't know if it's because I haven't seen a Michael Bay movie in a long time, because I sort of sat out the late era Transformers movies. I just decided, you know what, these aren't for me. I'm not even going to bother with them. But I kind of liked this movie. I think it really is Michael Bay completely unhinged and like let off the leash to do whatever he wants. And it's at times utterly incomprehensible. It breaks all the traditional rules of filmmaking, but it is pure Michael Bay style, just amped all the way up. And if that's something that you're interested in, I think you're gonna have a really good time with Six Underground. I want to
see this after hearing you say that. That sounds amazing.
I find myself like sort of in the middle when it comes to Michael Bay. I really like like The Rock and some of his early stuff that really holds up as like stylish cinema that actually feels like real movies instead of just a Michael Bay product. And this movie definitely feels like a Michael Bay product. It seems like the kind of movie of his that I would hate, but I think it might just be because I haven't seen him really let loose in this way before, or at least in a long time, that I just found myself like having a lot of fun with this thing. I didn't take it too seriously. I just decided to completely give up looking into or trying to read the movie in any way where he may be like making any sort of statement about anything, and like interested in exploring themes or anything that like normal filmmakers would do. I was just like, all right, Michael Bay doesn't seem interested in any of that stuff. He just wants every shot to look as cool as it possibly can. And I, you know, it's a long movie, but I ended up like walking away being like, all right, I would watch more of that on Netflix, where, you know, I don't think I would go to a theater to see Six Underground 2 or Seven Underground or whatever they end up calling it. But I think the aim here was for this to be the start of a franchise. And, you know, if you're a fan of Ryan Reynolds and his shtick, he's definitely doing that. And this is written by the writers of Deadpool, and I hate Deadpool, but I thought this was like, those guys are a good fit with Michael Bay's ridiculous over the top style. So I ended up kind of having fun with Six Underground. So you can check that out on Netflix right now if you're interested. Let's see what else. I watched a movie called Force Majeure. This is a 2014 film, I think written and directed by Ruben Östlund. And this is the movie that we were talking a little bit on yesterday's episode about the movies that we're looking forward to at Sundance. And there is a remake of this starring Will Ferrell and Julia Louis-Dreyfus called Downhill that's coming out this year. And this is a movie, basically it's about a family who goes on a vacation to somewhere in the mountains. I'm not even sure what country they're in, actually, but I think France. They're, you know, it's like a ski trip kind of thing. And they're out on a balcony at this really fancy resort that they're staying at. And an avalanche happens, but it's like a controlled avalanche that the ski that's done to generate fresh powder for skiing, and the avalanche kind of gets a little out of control and starts rolling in and gets really, really close, and eventually like comes like smoke from it or whatever comes over the like this restaurant balcony area. And instead of you know, grabbing his family and trying to get them to safety, the patriarch of this family just takes off on his own. He just like leaves them behind and runs away. I think this clip went viral relatively recently because people thought that it was real or something. I don't understand how that happened, but that was a Twitter thing for a little while. I ended up really, really enjoying this movie. I think it has a lot to say about like ideas of, you know, truth and perception and responsibility. And there are other characters in it where the main family sort of explains the situation to these other characters, and they voice concerns that we, the audience, would have. And it's just like an interesting exploration of what you would do in those type of, you know, high pressure situations and like how to live with yourself if you make the wrong one. So I found it really interesting. I'm very curious now to see if an American remake can sort of retain what makes this movie special. But I guess I'm going to try to see Downhill while we're at Sundance. So maybe I can report back on that. So Force Majeure is on, I think it's on Hulu right now. It might also be on Amazon Prime Video as well.
Did you finally see that because of the Sundance film?
Yes. Yeah. I, you know, this has been on my list for a long, long time. It's been like sitting in my queue for years and years. And it's one of those that I've always had a vague interest in, but yeah, I finally was spurred on to see it because of this upcoming remake. So I also saw The African Queen, which is a movie that is another one that's been on my list of things to see for a long time. It's like, you know, one of the AFI top 100 movies. It's like a really well-respected old school film from 1951. It was directed by John Huston, and it stars Humphrey Bogart and Katharine Hepburn. And this is the only movie where Humphrey Bogart won the Academy Award for Best Actor. So I'm a big Bogart fan, and I had not seen this yet. It is, or it was on Turner Classic Movies. I'm not sure if it's streaming anywhere right now, but search it, seek it out if you're interested and if you haven't seen this, because I really enjoyed the dynamic between Bogart and Hepburn. It's really like a two-hander where they're the main characters, and the movie really heavily relies on the chemistry that they have with each other. The premise is basically like Bogart is a crazy, like a drunken ship captain, and Katharine Hepburn is sort of like this stuck-up very like prim and proper religious woman, and they are together on this beat up boat in I think the Congo, and trying to decide like what they should ultimately do, and as war is breaking out, whether they should help their country or just sort of go it alone. So it's a really interesting movie, and after seeing it, it's like clearly it's obvious why it's so well respected. It's just really, really solid, well made. It definitely feels very much like the Jungle Cruise, the Disney ride, and I would not be surprised to find that this movie like inspired the design of that. I haven't looked into that, but I would not be surprised at all, because it's like so close to what I imagine the Imagineers thinking, you know, when they were designing that ride. And I just, with the new Jungle Cruise movie coming this year with Emily Blunt and The Rock, I just like watching this movie, I cannot imagine that film, which definitely is like supposed to be paying homage to the African Queen. I can't imagine that Jungle Cruise movie being half as good as this movie. So seek that out if you're interested. It's streaming somewhere, I'm sure.
What if Jungle Cruise is even better than being the African Queen?
I mean, I would be thrilled at that. I just don't have any faith in that actually happening. But I am open to that possibility and very excited to be proven wrong if that ends up being the case.
And you are right. The Imagineers, including Harper Goff, reference the African Queen frequently in the concepts or conceptual design of like some of the like stuff like the designs of the vehicles and everything.
Oh, cool. So I didn't know if it like if that appeared in the Imagineering story on Disney Plus. I haven't dived into that show yet or anything, but anyway, okay, so TV shows. I watched all of Homecoming, which is a show that's been on my radar for a little while. I remember Chris watching it and liking it. I listened to the podcast on which it's based, but this is a show that stars Julia Roberts and Bobby Cannavale and Stephen James and Shea Whigham. It's on Amazon. It's an Amazon original. And it's based on this podcast. It's basically about Julia Roberts plays this social worker who works at a facility that's supposed to be like a transitional center for soldiers coming back over from Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's supposed to be a place where she works at this place where they are supposed to be like eased back into society, and mysterious stuff starts happening. And then there's a time jump where later, like she's like 4 years later, I think, she's working at a totally different place and has a whole different life and can't really remember her time at this homecoming facility. So it's all about this back and forth time jump kind of thing as details get filled in and the mystery slowly comes to the fore. So Sam Esmail, who's behind Mr. Robot, directed all the episodes of this and I guess was responsible for it, you know, in some other kind of creative capacity. I don't know if he wrote the episodes or just was like the showrunner creator kind of guy. I really enjoyed this show a lot. Chris, I don't remember. I think I remember you liking this show, but did you have any specific things from Homecoming that stick with you?
I mean, no, I loved it. I thought it was one of the best shows I saw that year. And I feel like not enough people talked about it. It's just the style of it, and it uses all these musical cues from like 1970s paranoia thrillers, and it does this really cool thing with aspect ratio where the quote unquote modern stuff is done in like iPhone aspect ratio, and the flashback stuff is widescreen, and the way it brings those aspect ratios together in like a late episode like blew me away. Like I was so impressed with how they did that, and I wish more people had seen this.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the danger of the peak TV era, and like we're, you know, with all these other streaming services about to come, I'm just really worried about high quality shows like this going completely under the radar. Like, people, you know, TV critics will write about them in their first week of release or whatever, but like for people to actually be able to find these things, there's just so much stuff out there, and I just want to do my part to try to turn people on to Homecoming, because I think it's definitely worth watching. From what I understand, they're going to be making a second season, and I think it's supposed to be sort of mostly like a anthology style kind of thing. Like maybe some familiar characters from the first season are going to pop back up again, but it's supposed to be like a different director. And I think Janelle Monáe is supposed to be as the lead of season two. So I'm excited about that whenever that happens to come out. I have no idea if that's going to be out in 2020 or what, but anyway, Homecoming is on Amazon Prime Video right now. It's really great. I watched The Outsider. I've seen the first three episodes of that, which have aired on HBO right now. The show is basically like True Detective meets Stephen King. Jason Bateman is in it. Ben Mendelsohn is in it. Bill Camp, Julian Nicholson. It's got a really good cast. Cynthia Erivo shows up in the third episode as a character who I'm not fully sold on yet, but and I guess that's a good description of my thoughts on the show so far. I'm not fully sold, but I'm intrigued enough to keep watching. I think it definitely has that sheen of like prestige HBO TV. Like Jason Bateman directed the first couple episodes, and it looks very slick and in that sort of what's that show that he's on Netflix right now? Peter, you watch it? That Ozark kind of way. Yeah, exactly. So it kind of has like a little bit of that. It's pretty dark. Some of the subject matter is pretty dark. And there's also seemingly something maybe supernatural going on. It's really like, that's where the Stephen King element comes into play. It seems to be like a really interesting, like murder mystery kind of thing with like a bit of, supernatural stuff maybe lurking in the background. So Chris, I know you've seen more episodes of this than I have. Does it get better or stay good, or like what do you think about The Outsider?
I mean, I liked it from the start, so I don't know, but yeah, I've seen the first six episodes. I really liked it. I liked it more than the book, actually, so I don't know, but I would say stick with it.
Okay, all right. Yeah. I started rewatching Breaking Bad with my wife. My parents got us the complete series on Blu-ray right after the show aired. It came in this really cool barrel with like all this bonus material. There's like a Los Pollos Hermanos apron that I wear sometimes when I'm cooking in the kitchen. It came with like a USB drive and like all sorts of bonus discs and stuff. But I have yet to actually sit down and rewatch the show since it aired. So I've only seen every episode of Breaking Bad just once. And I wanted to wait for enough time to have passed for me to sort of forget some of the little details. I remember the show obviously in like broad strokes, but I think enough time has passed now, and that has been that assessment has been bearing out in my rewatch, because there are several details in the first, you know, four or five episodes, however many we've watched now, where I'm like, man, I can't believe that this happened this early in the season, or like this character is already, you know, catching on to Walt and his crazy lies and all this stuff. So I really, really love the show, and I would highly recommend watching Breaking Bad, as if anybody else needed a recommendation to watch, you know, one of the greatest TV dramas of all time. But show is really good.
Well, very cool. Chris, what you haven't been watching Breaking Bad, but you've been watching Bad Boys.
Yes, I went and saw Bad Boys for Life, and I had zero expectation for this movie because, you know, there was a long delay between this and the second one. It kept going through problems with scripts, and it kept changing directors, and I was like, all right, there's no way.
Also, the trailers look bad.
Yes, like everything about this was hinting at like a, I don't want to say a disaster, but not a great movie. And I was surprised at how good this movie was. It's, you know, I wouldn't call it a fantastic film, but it's so well made and it's so entertaining. And Will Smith and Martin Lawrence are really good together, just like riffing. And the thing I found most surprising about it is that it was surprisingly like grown up. And like, you know, those first two movies, they were directed by Michael Bay. This one has a different director. And Michael Bay is not a mature filmmaker. I'm not saying he's like the worst of the worst. I like some Michael Bay movies and I appreciate some of his style, but his movies don't have like, you know, an adult bone in their body. And as much as I enjoy how over the top and crazy Bad Boys 2 is, it's a really nasty, mean-spirited movie that I feel like you couldn't even make that movie today. And it's just like a really cruel sort of film. And this one sort of reverses that. And it kind of has the characters sort of like growing up a little bit and grappling with the fact that they're not these like young guys anymore. They're, you know, they're older now and they have to sort of like let their past go. And I was just really like, I was not expecting Bad Boys 3 to be mature. And I kind of felt weird after it ended, cause I was like, I really like that. And then I was sort of like relieved to see that it got like pretty good reviews overall. And it was like a surprise hit. No one was expecting it to be good. So it kind of made me feel like, oh, I'm not crazy in liking this movie. So Bad Boys 3, surprisingly good.
And what else have you seen?
I watched a true crime series. It's not out yet. It debuts on January 31st on Amazon, but I got screeners of it. And it's called Ted Bundy Falling for a Killer. And this really impressed me. This is probably like one of the best true crime things I've ever seen, because it does something you don't really see that often. And I don't think I've ever seen before in a Ted Bundy documentary, in that it focuses almost entirely on the victims. Like Ted Bundy is almost like a supporting character in this documentary. And the documentary is first and foremost told from the point of view of Elizabeth Kendall, who was his longtime girlfriend. And that was actually the focus of that movie, Extremely Vile, blah, 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 which was at Sundance last year with Zac Efron as Ted Bundy, which I kind of liked that movie more than most people, but it wasn't as great as it could have been. And this documentary shows you how good it possibly could have been, because it's really her story about how she fell in love with him and how she couldn't believe, you know, this guy was a serial killer. And also, it takes the time to interview like the relatives of not all of his victims, but a lot of his victims, like, you know sisters and mothers and people who are still alive, who just talk about, you know, their loved ones and how they were as people and what Ted Bundy took away. And it's like the complete opposite of glamorizing, for lack of a better word, these crimes. Like, you know, I love true crime series, but a lot of them sort of sensationalize and glamorize their subjects. And this does the complete opposite, where it just points out how awful all this stuff was. And it made me like oddly emotional. I was not expecting it. So I highly recommend that one. That hits Amazon on January 31st.
Okay, let's move on to what we've been eating. Brad, what have you been eating this week?
Chomping on some junk as usual. Two new cereals I got a hold of, candy inspired cereals, which the track record so far for those hasn't been very good. And that track record continues. I got Hershey's Kisses cereal, which I anticipated would at least be as good as Cocoa Puffs. And it's just not. It's the chocolate flavor is not there. Cocoa Puffs is just so much more, has like that genuine like cocoa flavor to it. And even like the milk that turns, you know, chocolate afterwards, it just wasn't nearly as tasty as I was hoping. And I feel like, you know, just as a nitpicking note, they really kind of missed the mark when it comes to the packaging, because it's Hershey's Kisses, and you would anticipate maybe that the bag that the cereal comes in would be like a foil kind of bag, but it wasn't, you know, just lazy all around. And then I tried a Jolly Ranchers cereal, which...
Is Jolly Ranchers cereal? Because, like, I can't... Like, does it have hard pieces in it?
No, it's just the... There's four different flavors that are modeled after Jolly Rancher flavors. And I anticipated it to be something kind of like Trix, with maybe a little bit more of like a candy sweet taste. But the flavor overall is kind of bland. It has grape, cherry, green apple, and blue raspberry. And the only flavor you really get in any given spoonful is the sour green apple. And I even tried like the individual pieces to see if it changed if you just had them, you know, one single flavor. And you just don't get it. Otherwise, it just tastes vaguely sweet, like, you know, a general, you know, hard candy, and not anything that actually tastes like Jolly Ranchers. It was pretty disappointing. So, yeah, if you were thinking about trying those, I would say pass. Maybe just wait.
I don't know how many listeners love this segment, but I just love that you actually seriously review the most ridiculous food items.
Like, I'm always curious about some of this stuff.
Okay, you tried Mountain Dew Zero?
Yeah, Mountain Dew Zero Sugar. They finally came out with like a good version that is, you know, a diet version of Mountain Dew that doesn't taste like trash. I've always hated Diet Mountain Dew more than any other diet soda, except for maybe Diet Coke. I actually hate Diet Coke too. but I've just never liked it. But this Mountain Dew Zero Sugar actually tastes pretty damn close to regular Mountain Dew, and it's to the point where like I could drink it instead of having like a regular can of Mountain Dew I don't like, drink soda super often. It's usually just when I try new ones, like for this segment or whatever. But every now and then, you know, I crave like having a bottle or a can of Mountain Dew. So as long as this stays permanent, I'll reach for this instead of the regular Mountain Dew. The only downside to it is it does have aspartame in it, which is apparently the artificial sweetener that everyone is really down on, because it's maybe not as good for you as people think it is. But the taste, yeah, it's pretty good. Definitely better than Diet Mountain Dew. So if you're looking for an alternative because you don't want to drink as much regular Mountain Dew, there you go.
I'm interested to try that. I like all the Zero Sugar line. I love Coke Zero. But it's weird. I think like they haven't been successful with their Zero Sugar line. I know Disney Parks is probably not the best example, but it is because it's a microcosm of tourists from around the world coming to a theme park, and they used to sell Coke Zero everywhere in Disney Parks, and now it's very hard to find Coke Zero there. Which makes me think that less people were buying it, because why else would they be like, you know, not having that available at every stand?
I'm not necessarily sure that's indicative of it not being popular overall, but maybe when people are on vacation and tourists at a theme park, they're not looking to be as healthy, so maybe they just go with the regular soda options.
Yeah, that's probably possible. Well, so what else have you been eating?
So there are two new Oreo flavors that just came out, chocolate marshmallow and caramel coconut. The chocolate marshmallow one is fine. It's not remarkably different from just a regular chocolate Oreo, but it has some bits of like marshmallow in the cream itself, giving it a vague marshmallow flavor along with the chocolate cream, but not remarkably different enough to really be anything to write home about. The caramel coconut ones are really good, though. I like the flavor of the caramel cream, and the coconut adds a nice extra touch to it. And it goes really well with the chocolate cookie. So that's one of the better recent ones I think I've seen. You tried these too, didn't you, Peter?
Yeah, no, I did try these. I like them. You know, they're not as good as like some of the stuff. Like I love the like peppermint bark Oreos that came out during the holidays. But these are very good. It has a good coconut taste to them. I would say that the caramel tastes kind of like that, like a weird fake candy caramel taste to it. Like it doesn't
That's
taste like real caramel, but it's not like it bothers me anything.
Yeah.
So yeah. So I'd recommend these. You can get these everywhere, right? Like Target and Walmart.
Yeah, they're all over now.
Yeah. Okay. Ben, what have you been playing this week?
Well, one thing that I've been playing is a podcast that I wanted to give a shout out to. I talked about this, I think, a couple years ago. It's called The Secret History of Hollywood, and it is one of the best podcasts that I've ever listened to. They just wrapped up, or it's really only like one guy. I think his name is Adam Roche, who is like the host, and he basically dives into all sorts of stories about – he focuses on one person from, like, the golden age of Hollywood and tells their – essentially their life story. So this most recent season was about Val Lewton, who is a producer who made movies like Cat People and sort of revolutionized the way that people saw horror movies back in the day. This series started in 2017 and just came to an end in October, and I finally got around to finishing the last episode. And the reason it took so long to do that was because several of the episodes are very, very long. I remember talking on the previous time that I mentioned this, where he was doing a series about James Cagney, where one of the podcast episodes was like 9 hours long. This was not the case in the Val Lewton series, but one of them was like just over 6 hours. So most of them are.
Why not split that up? I don't understand.
Well, I really think that, like, you know, it just works on a thematic level with what he's talking about. It really seems ridiculous, but I think once you're listening to it, it makes a lot more sense why these stories are broken out and segmented the way that they are. He sort of eases you into it. So the first few episodes in the 11 episode season, if you will, are only like an hour and a half or 2 hours or something. And then they sort of slowly get a little bit more and more lengthy, and I think it's because he just has a lot more research and a lot more story to get through during these sort of peak periods in these people's lives. But I cannot recommend this podcast highly enough. from what I understand, the Val Lewton episodes are still available on iTunes right now. So if you search The Secret History of Hollywood on your podcast app, you can find those. I would recommend downloading all of the Val Lewton ones right now. Those are the only ones that are available on the app. But then, and I think they're going to disappear because the Jimmy Cagney ones are no longer available, as far as I can tell. Maybe you can like buy them on Audible or something like that. But I would definitely recommend just downloading all of them if you have room on your phone for several really long podcast apps. And then he's got a new series coming out soon, a new season about Cary Grant. So I'm very excited to listen to that. But I just wanted to give another shout out to this podcast because it's a storytelling podcast and it is like the most immersive, well-researched, just like super high production values. It's like
an old school radio drama with like sound effects and...
Yeah, the voice work is like out of this world. It's so, so good. It's like one of my favorite podcasts of all time. And I think it's flying under the radar for a lot of people. And I just want everybody to at least know about this. And yes, the long podcast episodes are probably going to put some people off. But I really think if you give the show a listen and get sucked in, which happens instantly, then you'll be willing to go along for the ride. So it's called The Secret History of Hollywood.
Well, very cool. That concludes this water cooler episode. You can find more of all of our work at slashfilm.com. You can find this podcast, Slash Film Daily, published every weekday on iTunes, Google, Overcast, Spotify, all the popular podcast apps. Please feel free to send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns to us at peter@slashfilm.com. And please rate and review this podcast on iTunes. Tell your friends, spread the word, and we'll see you tomorrow. Wait, where's Jacob? We forgot to tell Jacob that we were recording this podcast.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. What do we do?
No book today.
Oh.
I guess we won, right?
I mean, did we, though?